I don't know if you knew this, but the world of podcasting is massive. Hi, I'm Leah. I'm the host of CBC's Podcast Playlist. There is such a constant avalanche of new releases, it can be hard to keep up. Luckily, Podcast Playlist can help. Every week, we deep dive into the podcast world to find the most compelling stories. And every month, we'll give you a sneak peek into the hottest new releases so you can stay ahead. Tune in to Podcast Playlist on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
One thing important that we have learned from astronomy is the story of the universe.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nahla Ayed. Today, the first of our 2019 series on the brilliant astrophysicist Hubert Reeves. He sadly passed away on Friday, October 13th, 2023, at the age of 91. Reeves was one of the world's foremost experts on the Big Bang Theory, the opening chapter of the history of our universe.
The simple sentence, "the universe has an history," is probably the most important discovery of the 20th century.
Not only is Hubert Reeves revered in the science world, recipient of the prestigious Albert Einstein Prize, he's also treated with rock star status in his adopted country of France, in part as a popularizer of science. Reeves believes that not explaining complex science is undemocratic. He's also treasured in Quebec, where he was born and raised. Yet he's not widely known in the English-speaking world, outside the scientific community. Until recently, Hubert Reeves was traveling the globe, giving lectures, speaking out about climate change and harm to biodiversity, and hosting classical concerts with poetry and spoken word.
Sans bruit, sur le miroir des lacs profonds et calmes, le cygne chasse l'onde de sa large palme et glisse.
A year ago, the 87-year-old experienced a serious health setback and has had to take a break from public appearances. But this past April, Hubert was able to travel from his Paris home with his wife Camille to their 17th-century country estate in Malicorne, Burgundy, a breathtaking property where the prolific author has written several of his books. And it was there, at the height of spring, amidst his acres of lush organic gardens and trees, where Reeves, despite the fragility of his illness, spoke with Ideas producer Mary Link.
Bonjour. How are you today?
Okay. It was difficult this morning, but now it is getting
better. It feels better?
Yeah. Yes.
We're calling this two-part series Finding Meaning in the Universe: Conversations with astrophysicist Hubert Reeves. Part one is The Origins of Us. Hubert, with the aid of a cane and Mary with her microphone, began with a short stroll.
Tu peux marcher un petit peu? Oui, tour du Malecon.
Promenade, oui.
Oui, tu peux soigner mon bras?
Non, ça va très bien. Avec ça, ça va très bien.
So, Hubert, we are walking in this magnificent place in the country in Burgundy. What does this place mean to you?
The paradise. I have been in many places in the world, almost every country, and the best place for me is here. The country, the trees, of course, this is a completely ecologically dealt place, so we can see some a little more of the butterfly. There were a lot more in the past, but still we have quite a lot. So for me, it's a place where I am well.
And it's also a place for solitude. Why is it important to be alone as opposed to with others in nature?
There is a Japanese expression that is called taking a bath in the woods, a bain de bois. And that means you go walking alone, it's very important, in the wood, and you think of nothing. You just look around and you try to get this perception that you have of the trees, the mysterious presence of the trees, which is not something that implies words, but implies things that you feel in all your body. And this place here is surrounded by a large forest. I have written many things here, which just came like this when walking. Yeah. But it's mostly before the idea of doing something, is the idea of feeling something. And it takes time to be in that mood.
Where did you learn to be kind of at one with nature? Because a lot of people are losing that these days.
When I was a kid, we lived in Canada, close to Montreal, Lac Saint-Louis. And in the middle of the lake, it was a large lake, there were a lot of marshes with turtles. You know, there is no more, of course. There were many flowers, many animals. And I liked to go there with the canoe and then just stop and just wait and look. And after a certain time, the animals come back. You see the butterflies, you see everything. And this is my best souvenirs of my first contact of nature, a sense of wholeness, being like a spectator, not an actor, just trying to let me forget myself, if you can say, and then to feel, to exist, to be in the world, to be in nature.
We arrive at a large courtyard at the center of the property. It's surrounded by ancient stone and wooden buildings, lovingly restored over 40 years by Hubert and his wife Camille. It used to be the stable area of a chateau nearby that has since fallen down. We come to a long wooden table on the lawn, a table that in the evenings is often full of visiting artists and musicians and writers, but right now it's just Hubert and myself.
Let us sit here.
Let's sit down. He's a small man who looks a bit like a slim Santa Claus with blue, twinkly eyes. And when sitting next to him, his kindness and humanity feels intoxicating. We begin the conversation with, well, the beginning. You're one of the foremost experts on the Big Bang theory. And if I was to explain it, I'd say it's the bang that led to the beginning of our universe. That's my simplistic take. But you call the Big Bang not only very important and an important theory, but also kind of strange. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, when it was produced, generated by the physicist, it was the most unpopular idea. Why? Because in the scientific tradition, the universe is eternal. It has always existed for all time. This was, I would say, the creed of the science after, say, the Newton, Galilei, the early astronomy. This was the dominant idea, as they say today. And then in 1915, 20, 2030, when it was discovered that this is not true, the universe has not always existed. Will it always exist? No one knows. But at least it has an age. What there was before that age, no one knows. But we can date the universe today, and it is roughly 14 billion years. And this is contradictory with scientific knowledge until then. And it was not very unpopular with the physicists because it was this, like, coming back, don't tell us you're coming back to the Bible, which was not very helpful for scientists who thought that this was obscurantism. And this was the reason why, first, it was not accepted at all in the Soviet Union. It was not even possible to speak about it. And in Occident, it was considered as something a little fancy and probably wrong. From 1920 to 1965, it was a very unpopular idea. Then came an event, a major event in 1965, which we called the radiation fossil radiation, namely the discovery of that light, radio light, that was emitted first moment of the universe, and that proved without doubt, I would say, that the eternal universe is wrong, and the Big Bang is the most likely scenario for the story of the universe. Now, when I say the most likely scenario, I don't say the truth. In science, there is no such thing as truth. There is something as the most plausible. You could also make a vote and ask the best physicists, astrophysicists all over the planet, and almost without exception, there is always some exception, they will say the Big Bang is the most likely story of the universe. We go from a universe which we thought to be eternal and unchanging to a universe which is very deeply changing, starting from something extremely hot, billions of degrees, and slowly cooling down. This is not important only for science, but also for philosophy, for thinking, for anyone thinking, anyone to understand the world, has to know what the scientific discoveries, knowledge tells us, and take it into account. And that is the very new thing that happened. Three things important: Einstein relativity, quantum physics, and the third one is the Big Bang. Whatever is your philosophy, the importance of this discovery is such that it has to be incorporated in any philosophy of the world, any vision of the world.
What can the Big Bang tell us, teach us? What can the Big Bang, what can the origins of the universe teach us as humans to make us more humane?
I don't know what to answer. One thing important that we have learned from the scenario and from astronomy is the story of the universe. And the story of the universe, a very important point, is the fact that the matter at the Big Bang, observed with the fossil radiation, is totally unstructured. There are no galaxies, no stars, no planet, no animals, of course, not even molecules, not even atoms. It is a very warm magma, millions of degrees, totally unstructured. And now, if you compare this state of the universe with the state today, one of the main differences is that our universe is highly structured. It has galaxies, it has stars, it has atoms, it has molecules. And all these structures were built during the life of the universe, namely by making atoms which congregate to make molecules, to congregate to make planets, to congregate to make cells. This is the story of the universe. And in this story, we, human people, are also one of these structures. Probably the most organized, the most powerful, the most efficient structure in the universe, at least on Earth, we don't know about other places, is the human brain. The human brain is a fantastically structured. And with this structure, we can destroy structure. You see, reality is that we are, what is saccage, what is it?
Sacrificing
our planet. So this is pointing to a duty, namely what we're doing is as serious as damaging one of the most evolved structure in the universe. You see, our body is made of atoms, and the number of atoms in the body is very large. Give you an idea, 1 of a 29 zero is the number of atoms in all your bodies. These atoms were presumably present in the Big Bang, but completely dissociated, not related to each other, just floating like in a gas. You see, when I make conference, I make the little experiment. I tell people, now I will have you to make a little exercise. You will close your eyes and you will say, I exist. Samely, I exist. You will take place, you take conscience of your existence. To be able to do that, which is the highest prowess ever made in the universe, it requires then one with 29 zero atoms are associated. And this is the story of all the universe, stars making atoms and atoms and so on, in such a way that they can realize this very simple doing, namely to say, close your eyes and say, I exist.
I exist.
So you have done one of the highest prowess ever done in the universe, and for that you need all your body, your toes, your stomach, to be able to do that, you need all that to work, to be in good shape.
And we need not to destroy that existence, that beautiful existence.
Exactly. So this makes a duty to human people. They are the owner of one of the highest, most powerful organization structure of the world, and they have to make sure of its future.
How can the Big Bang become past a theory? How can we prove the Big Bang?
There are at least 10 proofs of the Big Bang that makes it by far the best theory. It's not a truth, it's not a proof like if I tell you that the Earth is spherical, you can believe me. But the Big Bang is the best scenario, and there are several tests based on elements, abundances, presence of some elements rather than other. There are good, robust tests that the Big Bang is the best today. That doesn't mean that there are no other, but at least it is by far the scenario that it is most credible, most confirmed to observation.
I read somewhere, too, that one of the reasons, too, that the Big Bang theory is more credible or robust is because of the predictions it made.
Exactly. It makes us the number of predictions, this thing we observed, and this is always a very good proof. What we call the fossil radiation, namely this light that was emitted when the universe was only a few thousand years. The existence of this light was predicted, in particular by Georges Gamow, by other people, when it was found with exactly the good properties, to better than 0.5%. The fossil radiation is what the Big Bang theory implies. So this is impressive, but there is at least 10 things that the theory predicted after or before they were discovered.
Where was fossil radiation discovered?
Well, the fossil radiation, for instance, was discovered in Holmdale, New Jersey, and it was discovered by chance by two engineers of Bell Telephone trying to track the satellites. The problem was that you would send a satellite, and as soon as it passed the horizon, you could not get contact with it. So it was a waste of time. So it was necessary to find a way to keep contact with the satellite all through around the Earth. And these physicists found by testing a way that you could follow the satellite. And when they tried it, it worked. It worked when there were satellites, but it worked also when there were no satellites. The question was, what is this radiation that is covering the sky? It is not coming from one point. It comes from everywhere that you detect with radio telescope. What is it? What is the nature? And in fact, it was this radiation was predicted to exist before it was found. And this radiation is the best proof of the Big Bang because it replicates what the Big Bang should emit to within this accuracy.
Is it sort of the litter of the Big Bang on Earth?
It is like if you could call it an early radiation, which was emitted when the universe was very hot and it's still traveling throughout the universe.
When you talk about the Big Bang, the big question is, how can you have something from nothing? Do you think there's something before the Big Bang?
That nobody knows if there was a time when there was nothing. This is unfortunately implied in a little bit in the biblical literature, because the word creation, when you use creation, you mean that there was a time, then there was nothing, and then there was something. There is absolutely no proof that there was a time when there was nothing. And if you think of it, it is quite impossible. Because how would you know that there was a time where there was nothing? I mean, it's impossible. Then you need proof. To say that there is something, you need some kind of proof, fossil, something like that. Fossil from a time when there was nothing doesn't make sense. So one has to be careful about that. This idea of creation is a human mind creation. There is absolutely no basis to say, again, what we say is that there is something since 14 billion years. We know that. Before, we don't even know if there was a before. You see, you get into very delicate arguments when you think about these ideas, about the idea of nothing, because what can you say about nothing?
We find it very hard as humans to understand the concept of nothing, but do you think then there's a possibility there is such a thing as nothing?
I think the sentence means nothing.
I like that. I like that. It's just a concept that we're so fixated on, aren't we, as humans? We just cannot get beyond ourselves.
Right. It's implied in our way of thinking. And our way of thinking does not need to reflect reality. Modern science tells us very often that things which are counterintuitive, reality is very often counterintuitive. And I like this sentence by Haldane, a chemist. He says, universe is strange, more strange than we think, more strange than we are able to think. The history is that human people, life appeared on Earth, and intelligence was, according to Darwin, and I believe that, a weapon to be able to live. You have, in this planet or anywhere, you have to eat and not to eat. Language, ideas, concepts were first born in this very operational way. There is no guarantee that these concepts that we make are really touching the intimacy of the world. They're mostly operational concepts which helps you to live and explain the fact that our ancestors were not eaten by the lion or the bear and so on. So when you replace the history of the knowledge in a real story, you say, what is the power of our way of understanding the world, and is this power applied to such thing as the universe? I don't think so. I think we have a limited intelligence. I often say to my friend, you would not think of teaching geometry to your cat. You don't think he can understand it, besides he is not interested. So there is no guarantee that our way of thinking is able to go to the profoundest depth of the universe. So we have to start with that. The history is that knowledge is operational. It works when you want to eat and kill animals. There is no guarantee that it works when you apply it to the universe. The idea that I say, we have made science, we have learned a lot of things, but there is no guarantee that we can understand everything.
I think there's a lot of beauty to that, and that I've read in one of your books, you talk about, you know, the prediction horizon, where we have a limit to our knowledge. And in your book in Malicorne, you wrote about how meteorologists can predict the next day only accurate. 2 weeks from now is just a coin toss. And I went to our weatherman, I said, so how are you doing on that? And he said, well, we can do about 3 days. But he said 2 weeks is still a toss-up. Yet most people don't know that. Most people think that we have the arrogance of being able to predict 2 weeks and be able to predict so much. But there is a limit. There is a prediction horizon, right?
That's right. There is the idea that while it's only a question of making computer, that's not true. The best computer will not give you the time next year at the same hour. It's built in, not the instrument, but in the mathematics that we use, that there is always a border, we call it a predictory border.
Do you think we'll ever know if there's other universes?
Perhaps. Perhaps, and many, many things exist that we don't know. Or I would put it this the other way. We have no reason to affirm that we know everything. There is no proof of that. So we better live with that and live science like an adventure, which is a very powerful adventure. But how far can it go? How can we know?
The more we know, the less we know.
And you can say in a sense.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on RN, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. I'm Nala Ayed.
When faced with the complex moral questions the world tends to throw our way, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. My name's Waleed Ali.
And I'm Scott Stevens. We're the hosts of The Minefield, an ABC Australia podcast.
And each week we try to navigate the moral complexities of modern life in a way that's unexpected, unpredictable, intellectually serious, but more than a little fun.
Along the way, we're joined by a range of philosophers and thinkers who promise to help you see the world and the challenges we face in a different light.
You can listen to The Minefield wherever you get your podcasts.
This is part one of our two-part series, Finding Meaning in the Universe, Conversations with Astrophysicist Hubert Reeves. We're calling this first show, The Origins of Us. The acclaimed scientist is one of the world's foremost experts on the Big Bang Theory. He was born in Quebec. He moved to France in the 1960s to become the director of research of the renowned Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique. He is universally revered, not just for his scientific discoveries and leadership, but also for his popularization of science in general. Head to our website to learn more about Hubert Reeves. You'll also find videos of him answering some of the big questions, like which came first, the chicken or the egg? For this series, Hubert Reeves is in conversation with Ideas producer Mary Link at his place of refuge, his country estate in Malicorne, Burgundy. They turn to the question of whether humans will ever be able to fully understand the universe. At this point, 95% remains unexplained. The late physicist Stephen Hawking was one of the hopeful thinkers in search of the theory of everything, which would fully explain our universe through a theoretical framework of physics.
How can we understand the universe? Is it arbitrary, or is there a grand design? Do we still need a god? 20 years on, I need to find answers to the fundamental questions about our existence. Is undiminished.
Stephen Hawking thought that we would know the theory of everything by the end of the 20th century, and we don't. And you don't think it'll ever happen, because that's what we were just talking about.
Because our instruments are not, again, our instruments to knowing what is, I don't like the word the truth, but the most plausible version of what there was, depends on the power of our tools to analyze and explore the world. And our tools are the concept and the reasoning. And these are human invention, again, as I said before, who have themselves an history. There is no guarantee that our knowledge, our tools of knowledge, are able, are on the level to go to the deepest part of the world. Again, the world is strange.
Why do you think he, a physicist, would have thought that we would have a theory of everything?
Well, it's a question that has been debated among many people. It was true that there's an interesting story about that. In 1850, Lord Kelvin said, physics is finished. We only have a few decimals to learn, but almost nothing. This was before quantum mechanics, before the theory of relativity, before the Big Bang. So I think people have a tendency to overestimate the power of science. Science is a powerful thing, but I don't think it has an infinite power.
I wanted to read this quote. It's a bit naughty to you. It was about string theory. I don't know what you think about string theory.
String theory is the attempt by theoretical physicists to create one theory that can be used to explain all of the forces in nature. It does this by explaining all elementary particles and all their interactions in terms of tiny, vibrating strings of energy.
String theory has a long story. In the 80s, it was thought to be perhaps the final theory. Now we know that not only it is not the case, but it is coming more and more unpopular. Why? Because it never was confirmed by experiments. In science, the important thing is the observation. Quantum theory has many, many proofs. String theory have none. So for me, it is wait and see.
And string theory, part of string theory, if I'm correct, is that there's parallel universes, right? And this, as you say, it's not as popular. So now, you excuse me if I use a bad word, but there was an article I read recently in Scientific American about string theory, and it talked about how it's been challenged. And there was this cheeky, you know, méchant quote in the article, and it said, quote, "At its best, physics is the most potent and precise of all scientific fields, and yet it surpasses even psychology in its capacity for bullshit."
I agree entirely. I agree entirely. Unless you have a robust fact that tells you, yes, you search again.
Talking earlier, and you were mentioning how no computer, because we make them originally, will be able to solve the sort of theory of everything. But do you think computers will profoundly change the world if we continue to have a world? Do you think that they, because they talk about having, you know, intelligence, of having their own intelligence?
I know. Again, I don't know. Making prediction is a dangerous trade. I would not, I don't know. It's probably it will change things. It has already changed many things. But let's go back 40,000 years. At the moment when the human could master fire, it's a good thing. With fire, you can warm your house. You can also burn the house of your neighbor. What is important is not so much what you can do, but what you do. Who choose to do this? So certainly intelligence, artificial intelligence, will bring a lot of new power to people. That is clear. What will happen with this new power depends on who will decide what to do. Always through the history of invention, through the history of the humanity, from the fire to the electricity to nuclear, human people are very bright. They are inventor. They improvise. They find new things. The important thing on this level is what is being done with that. What becomes important is to make sure that these power are not left in the hands of people who are irresponsible. There is a great debate today about a story which is called Autonomous Lethal weapon. Namely, should we let inventors invent instrument that will not need a human person to say something? You see, this is almost necessary catastrophe.
Is it the computers themselves who will decide? No.
Yes.
Lethal autonomous weapons really means weapons that are meant to kill humans without a human intervention.
Lethal autonomous weapons could locate, identify, and kill their targets without any input from a person. These weapons would react too fast for a human to maintain meaningful control.
And many countries, the United States, but many other, some people are fighting to do that. Other people are against it. There is an Institute for Life in MIT where this is their aim, is to try to stop any institution who would have as its aim to have an autonomous lethal weapon. This is pure insanity.
I'm curious, and we're talking about destruction of universe and the, you know, atomic bomb and nuclear weapons. When you were at Cornell, you did your PhD in Cornell. One of your mentors, is it Philip Morrison? Is that his name?
It was Ed Salpeter. Philip Morrison was also, and Hans Bethe, all three.
And all three, and they were part of the Manhattan Project and created the bomb.
Bethe and Philip Morrison was in the plane who brought the bomb to Hiroshima. So they were just coming back. And the story, of course, with the student, there was a lot of discussion. And there was always this debate, was it worthwhile, should we? This was a very important debate.
What year were you at Cornell?
From 55 to 60.
So it was about a decade later, after the bomb.
Yes. This was really a very important subject. We were students and we were asking them about that, how they felt about that.
And so what were they saying to you? Did you talk to them about it? What were they saying in terms of their guilt?
No, we spent evenings discussing this. And Hans Bethe said this. The day of the bombing, they were all expecting to know what would happen. They knew that the plane was going. It had succeeded, and Hans Bethe, he vomited for the whole day and decided he would have nothing to do with that.
It was really terrible to see that destruction ourselves in these pictures. And many of us at that point decided that this should not happen again.
I remember Morrison's arguments were this. It was known that to win the war against Japan, it would take an invasion of the territory of Japan. It was estimated, with what accuracy, I don't know, that this would cost at least 6 million Japanese and 1 million American soldiers. And then the question. The bomb killed only 200,000. What do you choose? And on what basis do you choose? The choice was made. You know, when you think of it, if I had been there at that time, if I had been asked to work on the atom bomb, the Manhattan Project, I was too young. But if I had been there, and if I was a Jewish, and if I knew, if I know that Hitler is preparing himself his atom bombs, and that if Hitler has his atom bombs, the war could have been very different, I'm not so sure that I would have said no. I'm not so sure. You see, things sometimes are not simple.
Do you remember when you first were entranced, not just even by the night sky, but by the idea of science? When did that start to take hold in you?
Probably Lac Saint-Louis is a lake close to Montreal, and my parents had a summer house on the lake, and it was open. The sky was very largely open. The horizon was very low. And what I remember is the learning that the planets were wandering, were going throughout the constellation and following them and learning. You see, my interest in astronomy came from the attics of our house. All my uncles, after their studies, put their books in big boxes and leave them in the attics. And I spent a lot of time reading their book in science. For some reason, when I was 10 or so, I was fascinated by the sky, and I could read book on astronomy, and on the evening go on the side of the lake and see the planets moving in the sky. And that, for me, was really great. This is where I got the great emotion.
Then when you were 16, you managed to get a summer job, I think, mm-hmm. at Harvard, at the observatory in Harvard. Mm-hmm. How did you convince them that a young French boy from Quebec, they should take you and hire you? What did you say to them? What did you write to them? How did you convince them?
I had decided that I wanted to become an astronomer, but I wanted to know what it looks like in practice. What is the life, everyday life upon an astronomer? So I thought the best thing to do was during the summer to go to one of these observatories. And the one closest to home was in Boston at Harvard. So I decided to write a letter saying, could I spend some time with you? I don't know what to do, but I could do the dishes or some. And they answered me, one of the astronomers, Fred Whipple. Fred Whipple was a specialist of the comets. Fred Whipple answered me personally. He said, you could come when you want. I don't think you could help us, but you'd be welcome. And it would cost you $1 a day, which was most reasonable. So I went there and I met a number of people. For me, it's a great experience. It's a great experience out of Quebec, because at that time, Quebec was a rather provincial location. For me, it was getting on the world. I had a lot of discussion through religion, for instance.
Yes, because there you met up with a lot of atheists and scientists. Did you, at that point, at 17, when you went there, did you still believe, you were raised Catholic, did you still believe in God?
Yes, by habit, I would say, not by a personal discussion. I was born in a very Catholic family. Everybody believed, and as a good son, I believed. It was more like this. And then I came and I found that there were people who were not Catholics and who were really worthwhile and more interesting. In fact, I thought that the discussion I had with them were much more interesting because they were open. They were not all known. The truth was not written. So for me, it was a great experience in knowledge and humanity and in the world.
When people always ask you, you say whenever you have a lecture, people always ask you about God and is there a God or about spirituality. Do you tire of that question or do you?
No, I think it's a fundamental question. What I tell people, which is my point of view, I have no knowledge of any truth on this, is that there is no conflict between religion and science. Science is telling you facts, so there is no conflict. You might think the world was made by God. What I think is that I don't know. For me, I have no answer. But I don't think that the people who have an answer are wrong. I do believe that they have their own reflection, this has brought them to this point of view. So the truth for them is their truth. Some become very much believer, others are atheists. It's a subjective, it's not objective.
You say that science is not about morality. Absolutely. Science does not have morals. Science, that's where religion comes into, or philosophy comes into. They're two separate things and can exist together.
That's right. Science can tell you what it is, cannot tell you what is good. It's values, science will say, for instance, how to make an atom bomb, but it's unable to tell you whether you should make one. Science has no knowledge of what is good and bad.
In terms of good or bad, I'm curious what you think about the increasing exploration into space. You have NASA, who you worked for, but you have lots of countries. Israel just attempted, unsuccessfully, mind you, but attempted to land on the moon. You have private industries. Elon Musk and Richard Branson has a space tourism company. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's a bad thing. It is a dangerous thing. We have already sent many, many thousands, millions of objects. And the important thing is to know that even a screw would go so fast that it could destroy a satellite. Even a small piece of metal could be very dangerous. So there are now some experiments, some proposal to be able to clean, but for the moment it seems to be far away.
How messy is our universe then, or close by? How messy is the universe with things floating about there?
Sometimes you see in the newspaper a picture where you see all the little points and it is gray with points. But I don't think for the moment it is dangerous. The most dangerous thing is what the Chinese did one day. They decided to shoot at one of the satellites with a bomb to show if it would work. It crushed the satellites in thousands of parts. Each of these parts could be dangerous.
Dangerous, how so?
Well, because it means another satellites. If you break a satellite in a thousand parts, you make a thousand little satellites that continue to turn around the Earth and become dangerous themselves. If they hit one of our satellites, or they could destroy it. They could destroy. There has been this recent destruction of some of the radio communication satellites because of hitting a small piece.
And so when the Chinese were doing that, was that a sort of space warfare? Is that what Trump talks about?
No, probably not. They were trying to find out if their instruments were good enough, whether they had taken consideration the fact that this would increase the number of roaming objects, I don't know.
In terms of roaming objects in the universe, I hear there's an asteroid named after you.
Well, I should tell you how this come. A group of students of mine gave my name. I'm grateful for them. But it is small, about the size of the Mont Blanc, about the size of a big mountain, namely a few kilometers in diameter. It circles the Earth around Mars and Jupiter. It's just a stone. It's just a big stone. These days, as you probably know, there have been experiments on comets, Rosetta and so on, and we are exploring this. But this is one of the millions of rocks that turn around the sun.
Can you see it? Have you ever seen it?
No, you cannot see it. It is too small to see.
But you're floating in space, so you're always going to exist.
I don't know.
The asteroid that hit the Earth, that they say was most likely, or that led to the dinosaurs dying, the massive asteroid.
It's about the same size.
You're about the same size?
Yes, it's the same size as many other, including the one that has my name.
Wow, so you could hit us if you wanted to, smarten us up.
Yes, the fact that it happened several times. We have several crater, which were due to hitting of meteorites or comets.
Could tomorrow an asteroid come and hit us and do us all in?
Yes. In fact, there is in preparation a space watch, namely find out all the meteorites or comets that the orbit of which could meet the orbit of the Earth. There is not a big catalog that I prepared. So far, there has been no recent danger. Yes, in Russia, 2 years ago, there was, I don't remember the name, a stone not that size that broke all the windows in Chelyabinsk, somewhere like that.
So could there be an asteroid? Because we don't have the means right now to blow it up if it's coming to Earth, right?
The program today is what to do, and there are many research done on what to do if we would hear. Suppose that tomorrow on your radio, they say, we have spotted an asteroid, the orbit of which will meet the Earth, say, in 2000-something. What to do? There are many programs that are developed. One of them was to send it an atom bomb and destroy it. But that's worse, because instead of one big rock, you make thousands of small rocks that are still big enough to do a lot of problems. But there are other ways, which would be to try to deviate its orbit a little bit so that it would not pass the Earth, but it's not sure that this would succeed. And for that, you have to find it quite ahead of time. If you don't detect it less than a year, you have no chance to prepare yourself.
Do we have the ability to predict an asteroid, or could an asteroid still surprise us?
Asteroids have a regular orbit, so we can follow a long time. But comets very often come to us near the solar system for the first time. And comets, in the sense, are far more dangerous. But don't worry, the probability are very, very, very low.
Thank you. We're going to talk again later for another show, and we'll talk about whether there's life on other planets and chance and play in the universe and its effect. But I thought we'd end today with one last question. And I read somewhere, if this is true, that your favorite planet is Venus. Why is that?
Why? Because when it is in the sky, it's so beautiful. It's so shiny, it's so bright. When I go out in the evening or in the morning, depending on where it is, and I see it, it is like a sign for me. It's like a spotlight sent to you. I mean, that's all very selfish, but that's the way I feel.
It's something that you can see, that so much is unseeable in the universe. Is that part of it too?
Yes, and the changing, not being always there. You can wait for it, or you can be sad because it won't be there for several months or so.
Can we see Venus now?
No. Venus, you can see it only 4 hours before sunrise or after sunset.
What does it look like in the sky to you?
This is the brightest thing after the sun and the moon. If you see something that is unusually bright and is close to the horizon, either west or east, it is Venus. The next thing is Jupiter, but much less bright. So when you know it, I mean, you recognize it right away.
And when you see it, what does it do to you inside?
Like an old friend. An old friend coming back.
Thank you. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
On Ideas, you've been listening to The Origins of Us, the first of a two-part series we're calling Finding Meaning in the Universe, Conversations with astrophysicist Hubert Reeves. In part two, the importance of play and chance in our universe and our lives, and whether life exists beyond Earth. We also have more information on Hubert Reeves and videos shot at his country estate in Burgundy at our website, cbc.ca/ideas.
Hubert Reeves sadly died on October 13th, 2023, at the age of 91.
Special thanks to Camille Scoffier Reeves, web producer Lisa Ayuso, technical production Pat Martin. This episode was produced by Mary Link. Our executive producer is Greg Kelly, and I'm Nala Ayed.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.